From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, pundits are already speculating about Hillary Clinton running for president, and that's just days after President Obama's second term began. It's a reminder that today, it's always campaign season for most politicians. And of course, Obama earned his second term by besting Mitt Romney in the most expensive presidential campaign that's ever been waged, with each candidate raising and spending upwards of $1 billion. So the question is, where did all that money come from? What did it get spent on? And what are its implications? Well, the answer becomes quite a bit clearer today as the Federal Election Commission releases its final reports on the 2012 elections. And joining me now to explain what we can learn from these reports is Bill Allison, editorial director for the Sunlight Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that aims to make government, in their words, more transparent and accountable. Bill Allison, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So my first question is, do you get a sense from these numbers, both what's been released today and what we've seen released over the past few days and weeks, why it's so hard for somebody who's a challenger to defeat an incumbent?
I think this is true for at the presidential level and in Congress as well, is that when you're in office, you have power right now, and people are drawn to that, make contributions for the reason that they, you know, you can help them right now. You are in power, and, challengers don't have as much to sell unless they're, happen to be office holders. If you have a member of the House challenging a member of the Senate. But even then, as you're trying to move up, the incumbent senator will have much more attractiveness to donors than somebody at the, at the lower level. So that's one reason why you see this. And, to some extent, we saw in 2010 that super PACs were able to, and this was largely because most super PACs were operating on the Republican side, were able to kind of even that out, that disparity in the amount of money that incumbents were able to raise over challengers, and help with the challengers get things like name recognition and also do the attack ads. And basically, a lot of super PAC spending propped up and got challengers to the point where they had, almost the same name recognition as the incumbents. But in 2012, what we saw is that the Democrats kind of caught up with that, and they had their own super PACs, and things kind of leveled out a little bit more. And so basically, you just have that same incumbent advantage, that they raise so much more money than challengers, and they generally have the resources to, have the get-out-the-vote operations and the advertising that helps them win campaigns.
And one of the things we've heard is that even though Mitt Romney did a very good job of raising money, both himself and then also, as you said, super PAC sort of coming in and supporting his candidacy, we've heard whispers that the Romney campaign and the super PACs were not able, for whatever reason, to spend their money sometimes as effectively as the Obama campaign. Do you see that being true when you look at the numbers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And when you think about how the Obama campaign operated, they launched in April 2011. He didn't face any primary opposition, so he's raising money and building an operation for one election in November 2012, and so he can plan everything around that. He can do his media buys early. He can, they do the polling early. They figure out what are the battleground states, what their path to a majority in the Electoral College is, and they can really start early on building an organization for Get Out the Vote and making the ad buys. And again, they can make them months and months in advance, and that's the cheapest time to buy it. Because, if you think about it, supply and demand works in television time just like everything else. And when months in the future, there's much fewer groups have bought ads. And with the Romney campaign, that he only really started to raise the big money in April 2012 after he'd secured the Republican nomination. So he has 1 year less than Obama starting out, and that's when he starts buying money or trying to buy ads for these battleground states. So he's already buying in a much more congested marketplace with less time available. The rates are higher. And then as far as the super PACs go, I mean, candidates, at least under the Federal Election Commission and FCC rules, have to give candidate committees the lowest possible rate that they're offering to anybody when they buy television time. Now, that's affected by supply and demand and when you're buying. But super PACs don't get that discount. So a lot of the outside money that was helping Romney wasn't buying as many ads. So what we saw was that Obama may have been spending $10 million less in, say, Ohio or Iowa or New Hampshire or some of the other battleground states, but he's buying so many more ads with that money. So he got way more bang for his buck.
That must really scare anybody who's going up against an incumbent, whether that incumbent is on the presidential level or, you know, a candidate for the Senate or a candidate for the House.
Well, this is why, you know, incumbents get reelected, you
right.
know, so much
right.
frequency is that they have this huge advantage.
Okay, so let me ask you about when you look at who is actually giving this money, which must be fascinating to cull through these records. What industries, what groups are really at the top of the list in terms of forking over campaign money to Republicans, Democrats, you know, both sides of the aisle?
Sure. Well, if you're looking at, you know, just the super PACs and the outside spending groups, you know, a tremendous amount of money in 2012 and the bulk of it going to Republicans came from the financial, insurance, real estate. They were one of the biggest sectors. And you know, as I said, the vast majority went to Republicans. It was and just from the securities and investment part of that, which is, you know, the folks who invest in Wall Street, we're talking about 70 million went to conservatives, just 18 million went to liberal leaning groups, you know, conservative groups supporting Republicans. Again, we're talking about the outside spenders, not the candidates.
And is the financial industry, are they number one in terms of the amount given to?
The only one, I mean, you know, and this is, you know, one of the problems with the way that, you know, we kind of classify, and any classification system has its problems. They're number one. There is a category known as miscellaneous business that gets lumped into all kinds of different things, and that was actually slightly bigger at $154 million. But finance was $152 million. And really, if you break down miscellaneous business, it's so many small different sectors that those are like teeny tiny slivers.
Right.
So if when you're looking at these things, yeah, the financial, that was the biggest for the outside spending groups. And then the second one, actually, which is somewhat surprising until you realize, you know, who we're talking about, casinos and gambling comes in at number two, and
wow.
That's Sheldon Adelson all by himself. You know, there was, you know, and all of his money, you know, he personally donated about $52 million to, you know, conservative and Republican supporting group. So he was, you know, all by himself was one of the biggest ones. Labor unions were one of the biggest important, you know, groups on the left hand of the aisle or for Democrats, overwhelmingly giving to Democrats. You know, they altogether put together about $110 million that went to Democratic groups.
Okay, so we've got the financial industry and casinos, which seem to lean more towards the Republican side, and labor, and I know Hollywood is also in there, leaning towards the Democratic side.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Hollywood, and you know, and if you think about it, you know, one of the biggest supporters of Barack Obama and Priorities USA Action, which was the super PAC that supported him, was a guy named Jeffrey Katzenberg, who runs DreamWorks Animation.
Yep, used to be at Disney.
It used to be at Disney. He's a big fundraiser for Barack Obama. You know, there's if you go through the White House presidential papers, they have, you know, the introductions at different fundraising events, and there is President Obama thanking his good friend Jeffrey Katzenberg for arranging the event. Katzenberg has been big. Steven Spielberg gave money, and some other folks were also big on the Democratic side.
Okay, let me play you a little clip of a conversation that I recently had with Lauren Schlesig, who I know has worked with the Sunlight Foundation, too. And he's talking here about the influential effect of money. And then I want to come back to you and ask you about this as well. Let's play it.
If you look at it, you increasingly recognize the way in which money has been allowed into the mix in a way that at least leads ordinary people to wonder, is it the truth you're giving me, or is it the answer that helps your bottom line? And that is enough reason to worry about the way we're funding it. And then the second step is not just our perception. It's in fact the case that in a lot of these areas, the actual things being said are being affected by the money.
Bill Allison from the Sunlight Foundation, you were just talking about Jeffrey Katzenberg from DreamWorks, Sheldon Adelson, who runs casinos. How much of an opportunity are these people going to have to come before the senators, the president that they gave money to and say, here's my issue, please listen to it?
Well, this is what it's all about, is that the contributions do buy you a huge amount of access. And, if you think about what the big issues were in 2012, you had, the economy, the state of the economy, jobs, somewhat about, people's economic insecurities. I mean, this whole across the board. It was, people were worried about the economy, education, and so on. Sheldon Adelson's big issue is something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is a law that Congress passed a few decades ago and basically says that U.S. businesses are not allowed to break foreign laws by bribing foreign officials when they're, seeking business overseas. And Adelson has a casino operations that are being investigated for, possible violations of this act. And that's what was really driving, not all of his giving. I don't think that anybody can read his mind, but he even said that this is what was one of the things that was the impetus behind his giving. And I think that this shows that this is at the top of nobody's agenda but Sheldon Adelson's, but we may well see Republicans in the House revisiting the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The same thing with Jeffrey Katzenberg. His big issue was a World Trade Organization dispute with China. He was involved when the vice president was negotiating, Vice President Biden was negotiating with his Chinese counterpart to end the dispute. Biden was calling up Katzenberg and asking him if the numbers were okay. Hmm. And this is what gets the attention of members of Congress, the executive branch, is what do these big donors want? And it does somewhat shift the priorities so that the agenda that's set in Congress and in the executive branch takes what these donors are interested in into account much more than it takes what, say, the average person who's listening to this program is concerned about.
Let me ask you about then the number one area, where people donated from the financial industry, and ask you, what do they want? So you said about 70% of their money went to Republicans. Some did go to Democrats. Mm-hmm. You would think an industry that's been through what the financials industry has been through in the last 5-6 years, A, wouldn't have millions of dollars to donate, and B, would, maybe take a little bit of a backseat, but they don't seem to want to. So what do they want?
Well, and first of all, they would not, I think that it would seem that they would have tens of millions of dollars to spend, if only because, taxpayers bailed out, so many of these companies with TARP and with the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. But one of the big things that concerns this industry right now is what's going on with Dodd-Frank, which was the financial reform bill, the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was passed in 2010, 2 years ago. But what most people don't realize is that Dodd-Frank has yet to be fully implemented. And I think there's something like 240-some rules which have yet to be written or adopted in their final format. And a lot of these are the contentious rules that Wall Street is very concerned about, and that's why they're giving so much. Now, what's interesting is how heavily they tilted to Republicans, and I think it's obvious that they felt like they would get a better deal from Republicans than Democrats. One of the very first things that House Republicans proposed after repealing the Affordable Care Act was repealing Dodd-Frank. So clearly, a lot of Republicans are no fan of this bill, and neither is Wall Street, so that's sort of why they tilted so heavily towards Republicans, although on the congressional side, they did give an awful lot to Democrats as well, so it's not as if they do tend to follow incumbents, but that's really what the big issue is, and how this gets written and how these rules get written and how they're implemented could mean a huge difference between how you know, these companies are able to make money and how they're overseen by the government.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see where financial regulation goes and who is fighting for it and against it. I want to ask you a final question about, we talk a lot about the separation between the 1%, right, and the 99%, the sort of people at the very top who statistics show have increasingly been getting a lot richer. And I wonder about their influence on senators, on representatives, on the president. I'm going to play you a second piece of sound from Lawrence Lessig from the Harvard Law School.
We have to step back a bit and recognize what the nature of Congress is right now. This is an institution with an addiction. And the addiction is the drive which members are really forced to undertake to raise money, constantly raise money. There was one recent memo handed out to Democratic freshmen that instructed them that out of their nine-hour day, they were supposed to spend 4 hours raising money, 2 hours in a meet and greet, 2 hours doing congressional work, and 1 hour doing constituent service.
So, Bill Allison from the Sunlight Foundation, do you also worry about the breakdown between how much time lawmakers spend focused on the people who contribute money to them and how much time they focus on the rest of us who they represent?
It's a huge problem. And, you know, we hear this from every single retiring member of Congress. Not, I shouldn't say every single, but quite a few of them. You know, just today, or I'm sorry, yesterday, John Kerry in his farewell speech at the Senate talked about, you know, the pressures that raising money put on you and how difficult it is to represent the people when you are spending so much of your time raising money. We saw in the when McCain-Feingold was being litigated. This is the bill that banned soft money back in 2002, or the big corporate contributions to political parties. So many members of Congress said that, and this was a quote from Alan Simpson, but he talked about how if he gets back to his hotel room at 2 a.m. after being exhausted, and there's a bunch of urgent messages for him to call first thing the next morning, and he sees that one of them is a big donor, that's the one who's going to get the call. And I think that this is what happens with money, is that, you know, the politicians, you know, are so much involved in chasing after it. But the one thing I would say, though, is that this system exists because this is the system that members of Congress have allowed to evolve. They have passed the laws, they have set up the system, and as much as they may complain about the amount of time they have to spend raising money, I mean, I think the real problem is that incumbents have such huge advantages because of this system that they're very, you know, they're not very eager to change it. They don't want a level playing field where every single time they might face a challenger who could knock them out of their job. And, you know, this seems to be that the you know, with that amount of time, if you think about it, if you're a school teacher, if you're running a small business, if you're you know, if you have a full-time job, you're not going to spend those 4 hours a day raising money that members of Congress do, and you're not going to challenge a sitting member of Congress because you just won't have the financial resources.
Right. Bill Allison, editorial director of the Sunlight Foundation, looking at, with us at the questions of where did the 2012 election money come from, who may get a seat at the table in front of senators, members of the House, the president. Bill Allison from the Sunlight Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So are you the kind of person who shuns self-help books or recoils at the idea of going to one of those motivational seminars? Well, if your innate pessimism keeps you from deliberately pursuing happiness, you may actually be happier than the folks who are on that quest. I'll be bringing you that conversation next on Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to 89.7 WGBH.